Well, it is a great pleasure for this week's Nostalgia interview to catch up with Alexander Ornella. And wonderful to see you, Alexander.
Hello.
And we've known each other quite a few times. I think we met, am I right in thinking, through the Theology, Religion and Popular Culture Network?
We did, yeah. I was trying, when you reached out for the interview, I was trying to think at what point in time we've met. But I honestly can't quite remember anymore. But I was still in Austria at the University of Graz at that time. Some sort of conference that we bumped into each other. And you kind of were this big name in the theology and film popular culture studies person. It was quite an honor, from what I remember now, to bump into you and meet you at that time.
Oh, that's really kind of you, because I think it might have been 2009. Was it Schwerte in Germany? I think we were at a conference there. It might have been around that sort of period.
It might have been. But sort of, yeah, 2008, 2009 or something like this might have been the time, yeah.
Yeah, that kind of fits. And then we've both been involved in the network, and which might actually just be a good moment for you to say a little bit about where you are now and what you teach and research.
Right. So I'm at the University of Hull in the UK. I've been at the university since 2011. And my teaching kind of changed a little bit over time, and I'm sure we'll kind of have the opportunity to get into more details, but was hired to teach religious studies, and that kind of moved then more into sociology and a little bit of criminology. And at the moment, it's sort of a mixture of a little bit of research methods for students at the department, a little bit of sociology, a little bit of criminology, and a little bit of religious studies.
And your background in terms of your area of expertise within the study of religion, do you want to say a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, sure. So my PhD is actually in Catholic theology. I did that at the University of Graz in Austria at the Institute for Fundamental Theology or Foundational Theology, wherever you sit sort of in the English-speaking countries in terms of the terminology. And the department, I was at the Department for Fundamental Theology, the research area or the research focus was film and modern art. So my PhD supervisor, Gerhard Larcher, his main research focus was modern art. And Christian Wessely, who I think you know as well, who's still at the department, his research area was popular film. Like, he did his PhD on Star Wars, and that was sort of the intellectual environment I grew up in. So that conversation between theology, Catholic theology, modern art, contemporary art, and popular culture and film.
Yeah, and an area that I'm very familiar with, but also one that curiously was never really on the radar when I was an undergraduate. And I'm guessing it was the same for you, because, you know, we are in the same decade, at least in terms of age. We'll let the listeners work out what that might be. But you would have done your undergraduate degree in the 90s. And I'm guessing experiences I did a very different sort of landscape.
Yes, so I started my degree in 95. And at that time in Austria, we didn't have a bachelor's or master's degree. It was like the 5 years magister, master course. And the degree itself, there were like optional modules that you could take from the department where I ended up doing my PhD that focused on art and film. But other than that, it was like, you know, your traditional, typical degree in Catholic theology. And I kind of really stumbled into doing the PhD in that department, to be perfectly honest. It kind of never really occurred, like when I did my master's degree, it never really occurred to me that I would go on to do a PhD initially. So the only reason I started the degree actually was that at some point in time I wanted to become a priest.
And there was, you know, that's such a wonderful admission, because, of course, as we both know, and you know, and I know from teaching students in theology, religious studies, very few of them ever do what, of course, is always the stereotype.
So, yeah, there was, had it not been for that, I would not have studied Catholic theology. And at that time, at least at the University of Graz, there was no religious studies degree. So if you wanted to, you know, engage in conversations on the topic, theology at the University of Graz was the only option, really. So, yeah, the only reason I kind of subscribe or, you know, got on the degree was because the plan was to become become a priest. Obviously, that did not work out.
Do you find, I mean, in a way, you haven't fulfilled that particular expectation, but you also teach theology, and so in a way, I'm guessing you must feel that what you're doing now at least complements what you might have once expected that you'd be doing around now.
Well, I think it turned out well that I didn't become a priest, but I always saw myself. So even though the degree, so my PhD is in Catholic theology, but since the PhD was sort of sitting at the fences of what you would probably typically call, you know, traditional theology, I always kind of saw myself sitting in between fields of interest, but also in between disciplines. Because even though the degree was in the context of fundamental theology, one of the chapters was on the science fiction series Battlestar Galactica, and you know, the idea of like, you know, mind uploading and how do we define and think about ourselves as human beings in the context of technological development and changes that we are kind of driving ourselves. And those were conversations that at that time were sitting at the fences of theology. And I still remember I went to a conference, a conference in Germany, like a Catholic theology conference in Germany. We did a short presentation, and that was, you know, that presentation on modern art, film, stood out in the context of like all the other paper titles, and the questions that we got stood out in terms of like, you know, what's the relevance for theology engaging with modern art, engaging with popular film, with science fiction. So that experience, when I did my PhD, I think sort of that continued in my postdoc days, that continued like when I got the post here in Hull, that I always saw myself, and not in a negative way, saw myself sitting in between or navigating different fields of interests, different disciplines. And I always thought that was an advantage, like in terms of like how academia works. I think there was a disadvantage. I think in terms of like how academia works, how getting a job works in terms of ref here in the UK, I think I'm doing myself a disservice. But in terms of my own interests, what I can bring into the classroom, the papers I write, I really, really enjoy that, because I'm kind of hopping is probably not the right word, but I kind of have the opportunity to kind of tap into so many different fields. And if you kind of look at my list of publications, the variety or diversity of things that I've written on, I think testifies that I kind of really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds exactly why this profession, I think, has a unique kind of status, because there is that sort of fine line sometimes between, I suppose, what you call work and pleasure, which is very blurred. It's a very permeable line, I think. And it also does mean that sometimes you're getting paid effectively to read things and to do things that you might have wanted to do anyway. I mean, obviously the marking, you know, no one's going to sort of wake up in the morning and say, oh, I'm going to mark a batch of essays for the fun of it. But what you do is learn, see what your students are thinking, how they're responding and interacting with the work that you're doing. If you're delivering your research and then they're engaging with that and writing essays on it, then of course you have a vested interest in what they say. So there are huge benefits and luxuries in this profession, which, you know, I don't think you'd find elsewhere.
Mm. And obviously some of the things that you are able to bring into the classroom, one of the conversations, because one of the latest things that I'm working on is on sports. And every so often we got people in the classroom that are quite sporty and into their sports. So it's quite interesting to combine, you know, students' own interests with, these are the interviews I've done right now. And it's, I think, a good opportunity to actually connect with students in the classroom. And in that respect, you know, sort of the diversity of things I've worked on or I'm interested in him quite as an advantage for him.
And you find as well that, and this comes up on things like Facebook, which again certainly didn't exist all those decades ago, but students will say now, and I'm talking about students who might have graduated 10, 15, 20 years ago, they'll say, oh, thanks to that particular class you did in 2000 and whatever it was, or early 2000s, that it may have helped them maybe in the teaching profession, for example. And I get some lovely messages sometimes from students who talk about the fact that they did a particular module all those years ago and it's influenced or affected them in some way. And that's also one of the real pleasures, because, you know, you don't always get the financial reward. You don't get bonuses in this sort of profession. You don't suddenly, well, in fact, very far from it. But what you do get is that sense that you are, you know, if students want to do a degree in your subject, it's not like being in a school environment with children where there's going to be inevitable disruption. And you know, sometimes you perhaps don't get the chance to indulge your intellectual passions as much as you might like. At this sort of level, it's almost like the degree that you do and the PhD that you do is an apprenticeship for what can be a very fulfilling career.
And it's I mean, I totally agree. It's nice when, you know, a final year student, a third year student chooses to do their dissertation on, like, let's say, religious studies, because we've touched on something in the first or second year when they were taking a class with me on something that kind of really, really sparked their interest. But also when they leave university, one of the students I was teaching, he went on to do a master's in visual anthropology. And the reason for that was because in my classes, I use quite a lot of like visual methodology in terms of the example I use, but also what I ask students to do. And that sparked his curiosity. So he wanted to pursue that further. So it's kind of nice that you are able to give people sort of that environment where they can explore their own interests and their own passions and, you know, sort of give them a, like a little bit of a flavor of what they might be able to do, either, you know, in their final year of the university or once they leave university with their PhD.
Yeah, and I found that with one student who actually did do a PhD on Don Cupid, and I taught Don Cupid for a module I run called Death of God, looking at 19th, 20th century theologians. And she really enjoyed the week on Don Cupid. And this must have been probably about 2015, something like that. And afterwards, she wrote to Don Cupid and said how inspired she was and she wanted to know a bit more. And she ended up getting to know him and, you know, became a good sort of friend of his and did a PhD on Don Cupid. So I always find it very interesting because I was never that, you know, I'd be teaching all these wonderful names, but it never really have occurred to me because most of the people on that module admittedly have now passed on. I mean, Don Cupid himself is well into his 80s. I mean, very significantly late 80s. And so it's really interesting that sometimes there will be this sort of spark. And then the student might not just say, oh, I'm interested in looking into this further, but I'm actually going to contact the person and actually kind of, you know, sort of learn from them directly rather than from the books that me, you know, I've recommended on my module. So that's an interesting reward, but that doesn't happen too often. I did have a student once who contacted Richard Dawkins, but I think got a fairly sort of curt reply along the lines of, you know, why would you want to study religion? Yeah. Which is kind of in keeping with the almost, you know, the cartoon caricature that you might expect from Dawkins.
Yeah, but also, obviously, you know, the technology that we have available today lends itself for students to do things like that. Because I remember when I did my degree, if I wanted to like look for a book, I had to go into the library. Because yes, part of the library catalog was online or in an electronic, not even online, like in an electronic database. But the only place you could access that database really were the library computers. I think in the faculty then I was one of a handful of people in 95, 96 or so, one of a handful of people who activated their university email address. And like, right, I've got an email address. Who do I send an email to? Like no one really was using email at that time yet. So
No, do you know that you've just reminded me that I think the first time I ever came across email, and we could only use it internally in those days within the university in West Wales in Lampeter where I was, and it was January 93, so it would have been in my second year, around the time I actually started sort of keeping a regular diary, and what we used it for was often for like social things, it would be like, oh, are you going down the bar tonight or whatever? But what was interesting is that whereas these days you have a phone and you can contact your friends, obviously, and family wherever you are in the world, in those days you'd have to go to a physical computer room, a university computer room, log on, and because it would take ages in those days to log on. And when you'd go into the email, you'd send an email to somebody. For them to respond to that email, they also had to go to the physical computer room and log on. So, of course, sometimes you'd actually be in the room emailing somebody and then they'd walk in to check their email. You think, you know, in a funny way, it's and at the time, we, you know, if somebody had said to me then, oh, one day we'll be emailing people on our phones, or not even phoning, you know, direct messaging on our, exactly, on our, yeah, phones, which would take in our pockets, and you know, yeah, that would have felt like something sci-fi, like something out of Battlestar Galactica, perhaps.
Exactly, yeah. And in that way, I think we were quite privileged to sort of see that technological change, because it was like, without exaggeration, I think, a different world, a different, you know, way of interacting with each other. And, you know, the example that you just gave, you know, even if that person wasn't in the computer room, you know, they might not go back to the computer room, because like in Graz, it was not a university campus. And so the university had dedicated computer rooms, but they were like not anywhere where I usually went. You know, you had to go into that computer room, which was sort of on the other side of the city, really. And you might have gone there like once or twice a week. So by the time you know, it was not that instant message exchange like people are expecting or operating on today. So there was like a certain slowness to emails, I suppose, that you wouldn't expect.
And I think you're right. Yeah, because I've been in the situation now where I've like been due to meet somebody for let's say a coffee, and I've left work and checked my email before leaving on my phone and thought, yep, fine, you know, no new messages or whatever. And then it takes me about 20, 25 minutes to drive into work. I checked my phone again in the car park, and I saw an email from that person saying, you know, I'm afraid I can't meet you today, or something else has come up. And there might be a follow-up message saying, you know, I'm trying to get hold of you, sort of thing. You're like, that's in just the 20 minutes it took me to drive. So that expectation now of an immediate answer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always switch my phone off when I'm at the cinema. I go to the cinema, as you know, a lot. But that's probably the only time I ever switch my phone off. And
you turn it off like completely, or do you just do it on
I turn it off completely, also because there's obviously a part of me that, you know, when the staff come around, and I don't know if you ever know this at the cinema, but they sometimes come around with like infrared devices, I think, to make sure that people aren't recording the film. But I switch it off completely and switch it back on as soon as the credits start at the end. But also, in a way, that feels necessary, because that's also my way of saying this is the one time when actually it's inappropriate to have your phone on. But the rest of the time, I think, maybe when you're teaching, less so. But the expectation is that you're always sort of in touch, in contact with, or needing to be contacted by the outside world.
Well, these days you even need your phone when you walk into the lecture room, because like our ICT department has like activated two-factor authentication. So if I want to pull up my slides or anything like that on the lectern computer, I actually need my phone, because I need to like verify who I am.
And students now, and I only learned this in January, because I was on study leave in the autumn, but I went into my students' first lecture and I learned that there's some device now whereby I had to produce a barcode, and I had to find that barcode, but a barcode for each session, the lecture and the seminar, and then the students would have to use their phones to either, you know, scan it or write the number that appeared in the barcode in order to confirm their attendance at the class. So without a smartphone, that would be difficult, but all students do have smartphones.
Yeah.
Do you want to say a little bit, Alexander, about where you grew up? I know you're from Austria. Do you want to say a little bit about your childhood and background?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in Austria, like the very south of Austria. If you pull up Austria on a map, sort of that triangle, Austria, Italy, and Slovenia. So for me, it was quite natural. So if you kind of drive from my hometown to Italy, it's like a 20-minute drive. To Slovenia, it's a 20-minute drive. And for me, it was normal in my childhood, into my teenage years, when I was still in Austria, that we would, like, my parents and I would drive to Italy for lunch or dinner because it was a 20 minutes drive. Obviously, sometimes before Austria joined the European Union and, like, became part of the Schengen zone, obviously driving back was sometimes a little bit of a nightmare because of border controls and Austrian border enforcement or border officers trying to check people for illegal cigarette imports because they were significantly cheaper in Italy than they were in Austria. But it was quite a regular thing. And it didn't occur to me that some people might find it really bizarre or how not normal that actually might be, until a friend actually told me. So I kept telling a friend, right, today, when I was still in the UK and then visiting parents in Austria, and I kept telling a friend, right, today we'll pop to Italy for lunch or for dinner. And then my friend said, you know, it always cracks me up when you say something like, I popped to Italy for lunch. And I'm like, yeah, you're actually quite right. But, you know, if you kind of grow up, so I think in a way, my understanding of Europe, my understanding of the world in a way has been sort of shaped by growing up in that triangle. But yeah, growing up, so that's sort of the area I grew up in. When I was 18, obviously I left home to go to study at the University of Graz, and sort of thinking back of my childhood, my parents, my dad was quite and still is quite into like sports and nature. So I still remember spending entire days on the mountain, like skiing in winter or at the lakes in summer. And I was never as sporty as my dad was. He kind of dragged me to the tennis court and was quite disappointed that I didn't share his passion for tennis. But in another way, I'm quite grateful for that exposure to, you know, skiing, swimming, tennis, even though I've not played in like ages. I kind of gave that up when I was a teenager. But in a way, it was I have quite fond memories of growing up in Austria. And and then that kind of took me to Graz when I did my degree. As I said, I initially, my plans were to become a priest. Had I not become a priest, I would have studied economics, and I'm quite grateful that I did not study economics, because later, like when I finished my PhD, I finished my PhD just before the start of the financial crisis in 2008. Mm-hmm. And so I finished my PhD, the financial crisis hit, and that was sort of when I was applying for jobs. And I was like sent off a few applications to the United States. And then I got a couple of responses back saying, right, we're stopping the recruitment process because we're not hiring anymore. So I was a little bit in a state of panic. What do you do with a PhD in Catholic theology? I knew that I didn't want to teach in high school because that would have been the other option, because I, like, the master's I did was Catholic theology plus teaching religious studies, like religious studies in or RE in high school. But I knew I didn't want to do that. So I'm like, right, what is it that you do with a degree in Catholic theology? So I was a little bit in panic mode. And then I did a distance learning MBA degree at a university here in the UK. And that was sort of, in a way, a moment where I'm like, right, I'm grateful I did not study economics, because the literature, some of the literature I had to read for the marketing classes and for the HR classes was a little bit of like a wake-up moment for me, what's sort of going on in other disciplines. And not in a nice way, because even though initially I was interested in, right, you know, let's learn about marketing, I've, you know, the bottom line really of everything that I was asked to read was, right, how can we squeeze more money out of the consumer? That's kind of really what it boiled down to, even though it was kind of shrouded in the language of informing the customer to kind of make informed decisions. And the same with HR, really. It was actually quite awful, awful literature. So I was actually quite glad that I didn't go down that route. And I know I've ventured off my childhood a little bit, but I also grew up fairly very Catholic. My parents weren't overly religious, but I started serving as an altar boy when I was six, and I kept doing that until I was my late 20s or something like this. So a very, very long time. So I kind of was immersed in that Catholic, tradition for a very, very long time, and that kind of contributed that I thought I wanted to become.
I'm a big believer, actually, in that sort of notion of, you know, how we always end up doing what we are meant to do, in not necessarily in the form that we imagined. I mean, as we've just been discussing already, we didn't have social media 20, 30 years ago. So obviously we couldn't have imagined some of the routes that are open to us on our children or, you know, students now. But it sounds as though you are kind of doing very much, you're certainly following, you may not be a priest, but what you're doing is very much drawing on that same level of expertise and passion. And so in many ways, it's just another route that maybe your younger self wouldn't have contemplated. And as you said yourself, things like the crash at the end of the early 2000s, that could never have been anticipated a decade or two earlier. So it's not as though you could have mapped out your whole life and expected everything to fall in a particular way at a particular time.
I mean, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes I'm sort of thinking, you know, what would life be like, you know, had I not studied theology, but, you know, gone down the route of studying economics. And I'm sure that would have been all right. But, you know, I don't have like any, I don't entertain that thought for, I mean, usually, you know, it kind of, sometimes it creeps up, but I usually don't entertain that, you know, alternative universe for a very long time, because I don't really have any I can't really compare. It would be like an imaginary world that I would compare my actual experiences to. And then, you know, the comparison usually stops when I'm like, right, you know, who is it that I've met over the years? You know, not imaginary, but who is it that I've actually met? You know, there were people at conferences, were friends and stuff like this. And I'm like, you know, I would be in that alternative universe, you know, as fantastic life might have been, you know, I would have been missing out on all these great encounters. And I'm like, would I really want to miss out? And I'm like, no, because I've kind of made great friends. I've met fantastic people. Do I want to miss out? No, not really. Because, you know, those encounters have been so enriching that, you know, I wouldn't want to miss out.
Yeah, no, that's a very optimistic way of looking at it, because I do keep, you know, I keep a diary, which is very interesting in terms of, you know, I mean, obviously sometimes we're very busy people, so I don't have the luxury of doing this, but playing detective in your own life sometimes, of, you know, sometimes you think there are pathways open and you imagine that you'll be doing something very concrete in some cases, and it never happens. And it might often happen because some of the people who embody certain things don't end up following through, or maybe an opportunity comes up and maybe you lose the chance, or somebody else takes it, or whatever it might be. But life is full of all those sort of what ifs. But I do kind of feel that sometimes, like with my, I suppose, radio interest, I really wanted to do some radio stuff when I was young, and I kind of am doing that now through this sort of podcast. So it kind of feels like, for all those years when I wasn't doing, you know, before podcasts were invented, I suppose I just had this dream of doing something. But it was a dream that, you know, as with lots of things, you acclimatize and you get on with a busy life, and you don't sort of wake up in distress because you're not doing what you thought you were doing at the age of 5 or 6. Yeah. But that doesn't mean to say that you may never get that chance to do it, and it may come at a time. I mean, I'm nearly 50, but yeah. You know, sometimes you'd that would feel like a very, very long wait back when you're a young boy.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it's funny this that you said, you know, your interest that you had early on in radio. When I think back and listening to some of the conversations that you've had on the podcast, you know, a lot of people were saying that I had like this interest in film or TV early on. I kind of grew up fairly shielded from media because my exposure to TV, like my parents were very, I don't want to use the term strict, because in a way, you know, sort of thinking back, I don't think I really missed much, to be honest, but sort of my exposure or my TV time allowance was very, very minimal at that time. You know, in primary school, I hated it because, like, you know, there was the time where, so, for example, Knight Rider and the A-Team was popular, and everyone is, you know, I went to school and everyone was talking about the latest series that they saw, and I had like absolutely no clue because I wasn't allowed allowed to watch it. But you know, that came to the benefit of like other stuff we did. But you know, sort of in a way, at that point in time, I would have never imagined that I would at some point, you know, end up teaching stuff that involves film, popular culture, or technology. And I think also, so you know, thinking back of like childhood in terms like in terms of how I see myself, some of the crucial encounters that still sort of resonate with me and shape me politically, I suppose, in a European context, I guess, were sort of, you know, a few things really. And one of those things is sort of my dad's attitude towards the environment. And as I said earlier, you know, he had a great interest in the environment. And one of the things that was a staple at home was my dad watching like environmental documentaries. They were running on Austrian TV at the time. But also documentaries about like different cultures and stuff like this, and the impact European colonialism had on other cultures. So that on the one hand, that kind of came from my dad, and that kind of in a way shaped me. The other thing that shaped me was like an event in, I can't quite pinpoint the exact date anymore, but like 94, 95, when Austria joined the European. So it was in my last or next to the last year of high school, I was taking Italian classes. And so Austria joined the European Union, became part of the Schengen area. And as part of, you know, the lead up to that, you know, sort of the hype that politics wanted to create for that, there was a small ceremony at the Austrian-Italian border, you know, sort of this a symbolic removal of the border barrier thing. And our Italian teacher took us there. And at that point in time, I wasn't aware of the significance. At that point in time, I was like, yes, we are not doing Italian, because I was not very good in Italian. I was like, yes, I was the typical student in high school. Yes, we're not doing Italian. We're out of school. Great opportunity. And I wasn't aware of sort of, you know, the impact that this, the participation would have. Because thinking back, sort of that symbolic removal of a border barrier really kind of, you know, sort of, I thought, opened up breathing room. And, you know, the unrestricted travel between countries, because for me as a child, it was always like, you know, I didn't understand why there is this artificial border, because things on the other side of the border looked exactly the same for me as a kid than, you know, on this side of the border. Yes, there was another language and there was another currency, but there was just inconvenience, really. But, you know, it opened up a breathing room. And one of the hurtful things that, you know, sort of the reintroduction of border controls across Europe with, like, you know, that quote unquote migrant crisis in 2015, 2016, is, you know, sort of emotionally quite a hurtful experience for me. And that kind of goes back to that experience I made at the border, and it's part of my childhood, because it kind of gave me a little bit of a taste of what Europe or what the world really could be like if it wasn't for artificial barriers that people kind of put into each other's lives.
Yeah. And it's interesting, isn't it, how those sort of background experiences can come in handy in a way, in a very kind of unexpected sort of fashion, because you suddenly, you know, you have that sort of invaluable experience of what was going on in Europe, and at a time when you say Austria wasn't in the EU, etc. And then you look at what's happened and what happened to Britain in, you know, well, I say in 2016, but that was just the beginning of it. But in terms of Brexit and so on. And then, you know, you kind of feel that nostalgia comes up in this context a lot, because you suddenly realize that you've got this awareness, this memory of having lived through something which kind of, it doesn't exist anymore in anything like the same way. And of course, you can see why people get very romantic about the past. Is that something that sort of intersects with your understanding? Do you sort of look back on that childhood and sort of see it as something very wondrous?
I suppose so, in a way. And kind of, again, that kind of is probably linked to what's happening at the moment. So my, you know, if I think back of my childhood, it's lots and lots of snow in winter and beautiful summers. And if I look at winters in Austria now, I mean, hardly any of the ski resorts would still operate if it wasn't for artificial, you know, the ability to produce snow. And a number of ski resorts actually that where I was as a kid closed down and are not operational anymore because it wouldn't be like financially, economically feasible to produce snow for like the smaller resorts. So in a way, I think I was quite lucky in my childhood in terms of like, if I look back, you know, sort of in a romantic view or like from a romantic or nostalgic view, I wouldn't be able to give you an answer. I think it kind of makes me probably a little bit more angry than anything else, because I'm like, right, you know, had we as a society or, you know, our elected politicians some 10, 15 years ago made other decisions, we wouldn't be necessarily in the position that we're in right now. And, you know, sort of the frustration that collectively, at least, we don't really seem to be learning a whole lot. So I think it's a mixture of feeling. It's feeling grateful for when I was a kid, but that also comes sort of with the responsibility, because when I said, you know, collectively, we don't seem to be learning, obviously, you know, I'm part of that collective, in a way, even though I try to kind of make better decisions. But looking back, I think I'm quite grateful for the experiences that I was able to make.
And I'm just picking up on something you were saying about how you didn't engage with media when you were young in the same way. And I wonder if there's a pattern here, because, well, it was similar in my case, but you may not have engaged with those Knight Riders or, you know, programs when you were young, but that ended up becoming your sort of a research interest, or certainly an area that, you know, that you're teaching on, etc. And I think in my case, I kind of missed first time round a lot of the, you know, I mean, I was in primary and secondary school in the 80s. So the world of Ghostbusters, Indiana Jones, Back to the Future, I kind of missed first time round. But because I missed it first time round, I feel that when I engage with those films now, I do it on many more levels, because I'm imagining it, you know, what was it like for my friends, you know, what were the bits of conversations that I pick up on in the classroom, in the school playground? And all those years later, suddenly it all kind of rounds out, fleshes out these, myself included, these characters and the things that matter to us, the things that matter to us then, the things that matter to us now. And I feel that it's, you know, there's a time and a place for everything. I think that sounds a bit like Ecclesiastes, but it feels that sometimes you're just not at the right place to do something like a PhD. We were talking before we started recording that some people these days don't obviously have the same luxury to do a PhD at the age of 21 or whatever, because of, not least because of financial pressures, and you might do it a bit later on, but maybe you can do it a more rewarding examination. You can do a study when you're in your 30s, 40s or 50s, because you're doing it at the right time for yourself, rather than sort of trying to do it because you're compressing your whole sort of educational journey into a few years immediately following secondary school. So I do wonder whether we tend to perhaps benefit sometimes from taking a little bit of time out to reflect, and that might open up new unexpected pathways.
Yeah, I suppose so. I think one of the challenges probably is, you know, sort of comparing my own childhood and exposure or lack of exposure to media to what, you know, kids today are exposed to. And I suppose it's also the kind of, like, once I had the opportunity to watch and catch up, I quite had an early interest in science fiction, and that sort of probably has to do with my general interest in technology in a different life. I probably would I'm like absolutely fascinated with technology. I tried to do a computer science degree before I started working on my master's thesis in Austria, And unfortunately, that came to a halt. So in the second year, one of the first classes was statistics. I'm like, right, this is the end of my computer science degree. Unfortunately, my brain isn't mathematically wired, but I've had quite an early interest in technology, in computers. When I did my PhD, I was like with old computers building my own servers. So I had a server running at home with a free BSD operating system on there, and I got so annoyed with carrying the latest version of a PhD chapter into the office that I had like a file versioning system running on it. So there was just a time before Dropbox, like services such as Dropbox, became popular. But I think I knew from, like, even though I had that interest in technology, I knew, right, I probably, you know, this is not the degree I could potentially study. But I think I made up for that in various different ways by, you know, watching science fiction stuff, writing about technology, and, you know, thinking about technology or expressing my fascination with technology in that way.
And you just reminded me of something that my PhD examiner, supervisor said many, many years ago, which is that sometimes the best work is when it's at the intersection between disciplines. And I think in your case, and it's the same with me, I've had this huge interest in media, radio, and obviously my PhD was in film. But I'm looking at film from a very different disciplinary background, namely theology, religious studies. Mm. And I think that therefore I have a more sort of privileged or unique sort of sense of being able to do this sort of thing. I write lots of film reviews, but I do it as somebody whose background is in theology, religious studies. So in a funny way, it gives me more of an edge. It means I've got something quite distinctive to offer rather than just sort of doing it because my background is in film. I mean, often in a world where universities are going through all sorts of tough times, people often say, oh, you know, you could teach in film studies or be redeployed there. But I also know that wouldn't work in the sense that really isn't my, you know, I really have to retrain and reskill. Mm. And I'm kind of glad that I have the background that I do, but it's like everyone has a lens. Even if you do have a background in film and you're looking at film, you have a particular, you know, semiotic, structuralism, psychoanalysis, whatever it might be. So we all do that. So everybody is writing from a vantage point. There's no sort of idea that you have this pure sense of I'm writing an objective review of a film. Of course, we're all looking at it through whatever, you know, the fact that we chose to write on the films that we did also mm-hmm. says a lot about the people that we are.
Yeah. And I think one of the points that I'm approaching, like visual material or films, is I think, you know, that theological training that I had at university throughout my master's and my PhD degree. And that's kind of the message that I try to get across with to students in class as well. You know, what is it that, you know, not only, you know, why do we watch films, but, you know, what is it that they actually teach us? And I think a lot of films, short films or feature films, especially when they kind of sit at that intersection of like society, technology, or society, technological innovation, in a way, are stories and narratives of what it means to be human. And, you know, how do we see society? How do we make sense of society? And I think there are great opportunities to think about those issues. And some of the things that I've done in class was, you know, take short films into the classroom, like short science fiction films, take them into the classroom. And, you know, the way I would approach them would be informed by my theological training. And I can kind of see that, you know, if you're missing that theological training, that theological lens, there's a lot of heavy lifting that you need to do in a way to kind of, you know, frame that in that way. Because otherwise it's just, you know, a story about like individual character and their struggles or their augmentedness. But
yeah, and also it makes for really enriching conversations because you're looking at something through a very idiosyncratic lens and also quite a creative one because you don't have lots of other people sort of almost like fighting for that contested space. You sort of you're coming at it from an area using the skills that you have quite comfortably, but applying it to another sort of area rather than claiming that you've got some kind of like definitive sort of, you know, hold on that. You're aware that if you're in a room with other people, you might have a very different take on it to them, and that actually can work to your advantage.
Yeah. And what also sort of that training early on, both sort of in theology and sort of that focus of the department where I was at Graz on like modern art, film, TV, popular culture, sort of the visual. I think sort of, you know, my PhD kind of was engaging to some extent with Battlestar Galactica, and I've published on film, on TV series. But I think that was sort of the starting point, really. And then I kind of branched out into not just popular culture, but I think a lot of stuff that I've done was on visual things, because that kind of in a way has always intrigued me to some extent. And that informed, you know, that informed my understanding of Europe and sort of, you know, the issue of borders or the lack of borders as well, and the, you know, some of the research that I've done, sort of one of the, and sort of the, your own irritations in a way, going back to the issue of borders, one of the papers I've done was actually sort of on my experience, or the starting point was that experience of like one time when I was driving a few years ago from the UK back home to Austria over summer. When you kind of drive through the different countries, I noticed that, right, you know, sort of there are, not only are there no border checkpoints, but I kind of missed a couple of borders. I'm like, right, where was the border sign? Because, you know, I wanted to know when I crossed a country border. So I was kind of fascinated with the visibility or invisibility of borders. And, you know, the meaning that people associate or attach to that. And again, that also links to the intersection of like technology, because a lot of those border checkpoints are today invisible, that we kind of don't really see.
That's a really, I don't know if that was intentional on your part, but what a wonderful sort of metaphor for the academic, you know, so the geographical journey in your car and actually what you do in disciplinary terms as part of your academic work of actually not necessarily, of seeing those boundaries, not just as porous, but in some cases, as to use your own word, invisible.
They certainly are. Whenever, you know, there's this ambivalence of like visibility and invisibility, I think it prompts questions. And I think that's one of the opportunities that you can do as a religious studies scholar. And sort of this visibility and invisibility, I think that also features like, you know, in other discussions when you talk about the environment and, you know, CO2 removal, technologies, and, you know, sort of it, that's also something that's on the one hand very, very invisible, but we got to do something about it. We all know it's out there, but, and we all know we got to reduce it, but it's very intangible. And then you kind of got these ideas that we got to build those CO2 removal plans that magically gonna make this thing that's intangible into something that's maybe a little bit more tangible in terms of making a useful resource out of it. And that's also really, really fascinating. So all the conversations around, you know, that technology of CO2 removal, where you take something that humanity produces out of excess, like turn something that's bad into something that's actually good, like as a, like a positive resource. I find it absolutely, absolutely fascinating. So you kind of take something that's bad and magically turn it into something that becomes a rich resource for all those different industries, like the food industry and the fuel industry and so on. Those are some really, really interesting conversation. And again, it kind of taps into questions of usefulness. I think it taps into questions of good and bad. I don't want to use the term evil, but, you know, good and bad. And it taps into the question of not just, you know, what's technologically feasible, but it taps into question of sacrifice is probably too big of a word, but sort of the visual element is there, because if you look at sort of the promises of what the how the technology is sold, it's like this utopian land that comes with snow-covered mountains, this untouched land where, you know, humanity lives in harmony with the environment. And like, you know, this is so detached from reality, really. But, you know, it's part of those promises and the stories that we tell ourselves for whatever reason.
Well, that segues really well into my last couple of questions, because that whole notion of whether we can be nostalgic about negative experiences, for example, and the way that we interact with the past, maybe reframe the past, reclaim the past, maybe in some cases. Is that something that you've thought about?
Yeah, so I've heard you ask that question on the podcast or discuss the question about like painful experiences with other people. And I think sort of the consensus on your podcast, but also if you kind of read stuff about negative experiences or challenges, you know, identity negotiations, what makes someone, you know, the person they are. And in all these discussions, you know, negative experiences or failures feature quite prominently in terms of we need that to grow. And I have to say, I'm a very, very impatient person, but at the same time, I'm also a person, I'm not overly keen on painful experiences. So the entire narrative that, right, you know, as human beings, we kind of need painful, or we grow from painful experiences. I'm like a little bit skeptical towards those narratives, because I'm like, right, really, do we need that? Because, you know, what is it that we're actually talking about? Because, like, you know, personal challenges, you know, are different for everyone. And, you know, someone might be in a privileged position to call painful experiences they've learned from, that for someone else is, you know, everyday experience. And one of the things I tell my students in class every so often is, like, when we talk about sort of in sociology or classes, sometimes I kind of try to sort of instill, or, you know, sort of when we talk about the state of society, kind of tell people, right, you know, this is what we are talking about, and what can we do to change? And one of the things that are a big irritation for me is that I think we don't need a lot to make the world like a better place. And I know that sounds a little bit preachy maybe, but I kind of often tell my students, right, I think if everyone tried to smile just a tiny little bit more in their life, you know, sort of made the effort to smile or be friendly to a random person they encounter in their life, if that's in the grocery store, in a coffee shop, or wherever, you know, just sort of make the effort to, like, you know, a friendly encounter a day, then I think, you know, that would change a lot of the dynamic that that we're seeing right now. So I think, you know, what does it mean about painful experiences? I think we need more friendly encounters, more friendly experiences rather than painful experiences, because I think it's those friendly experiences that I think make us grow as well. And that's what I'm kind of missing in the conversation. And you mentioned early on saying, you know, it's such a pleasure, especially, you know, if you're in academia, if, like, in the years after you've taught a student, if they email you and say, right, you know, I really enjoyed that class, and this is how it benefited me. Yes, it might have been a tough class, but, you know, it was like this positive experience. And when I kind of think back, yes, I've had painful experiences or pain experiences that I wish I hadn't made. But I think what I try to let inform myself in terms of my interactions, I think I draw much more on those positive experiences and the energy of those positive experiences. So that's the issue I'm having, sort of, you know, when we kind of talk about challenges, painful experiences. Let's talk more about, like, positive stuff.
You're onto something there, because, of course, it's the framing, because at the time, is I can think of very painful experiences in my life. And I can look back now and think, you know, maybe, oh, I survived that, or I'm still here. And so, of course, you reconceptualize those events. I suppose, to use a very prosaic example, because we both work with students, a student might be really struggling. They might be worried about the degree they're going to get. They're going to maybe worry they'll get a degree at all, or, you know, all sorts of pressures in their life. If it all works out for them and they get a really good degree, and then, you know, life goes well, then they might in later years look back and think, well, it worked out okay. You know, so, you know, it's because of that that I'm where I am now. But I remember one student many years ago who did a really good essay, and I said, "Oh, you know, well done." And she burst into tears, and I thought, "Hang on, you got a first class mark. You know what? Why?" And she said she was up all night for many nights. She has to take all sorts of pills. She was, you know, effectively probably signed off by her doctor and all sorts of things. And she said, "I can't sustain that for the rest of my degree." Well, she did. She got a first class degree. But at the time, it just made me realize that, you know, here was a student who was doing phenomenally well. From my point of view, she was getting all the right marks. But that didn't mean to say that her whole life was wonderful and happy. Very far from it. In fact, actually, if it was causing that much pain to create something so good, then I think she was probably asking herself whether it was really worth it. So somehow everything worked out in the end. But that was just a bit of a wake-up call to me that, you know, sort of assuming that somebody writes a good essay and then is really happy and does the next one and is really happy, that actually there's a lot that's missing there. I have one more question for you, Alexander, and that is whether you would consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
You know, I was dreading that question, and I knew it's going to come because you've asked everyone that question. And I've thought a lot about how to answer that question, and I'm not entirely sure, to be honest. I don't consider myself looking back too much, really. You've mentioned sort of writing a journal. I've tried it once and I realized that's not for me. I found it not a very, very rewarding experience. I think I'm probably sitting in the middle, and I think the best answer that I can probably give you is that I think I try to enjoy the here and more, or the here and now, more so than I definitely wouldn't consider myself a looking back person. Maybe a little bit of a looking forward person, but I think what's more important for me is, right, this is where I am at this point in time, and how can I make the most out of that. That's probably the best answer I can give you, because I think looking forward, there's like so many uncertainties, and like we kind of touched like briefly on some of them. And yes, you can sort of look forward and like make plans and, you know, sort of draw a picture of where you see yourself in 2 years, 5 years down the line, or look forward to something. But I think what's probably more important is, for me at least, to kind of, you know, reflect on or think about, right, this is where I am at this point in time. And that also kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier in terms of what I kind of tell students sometimes in class. It's, you know, from an academic perspective, from a personal perspective, it's all right to think about, right, how can we make society like a better place in like 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the line? How do we deal with like environmental change that's, you know, that and stuff like this? But I think, what is it that where we are at this point in time, and what can we do, or how can we enjoy what we have at this point in time, and what's our responsibility now? And how can we, not only how can we enjoy life or how can we enjoy today, but also a little bit, how can we make each other's life better, not tomorrow, but today? And that kind of goes back with, you know, maybe a friendly encounter, not like tomorrow, but today. So I think I'm sitting in the middle, and I'd say, you know, let's focus on today and the conversations we have today, such as the podcast that we have today.
No, and that's a really good insight, because I'm not somebody who is a big fan of binaries, and yet I ask a very binary driven question at the end, but your answer is actually a really perfect one, because you're like, well, it doesn't have to be one or the other, but it can actually be that if we focus on one or the other, we're maybe missing something more valuable that is important today. Well, you know, Alexander, that has been a terrific catch. I think we covered a huge amount of ground, and thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Well, thank you very much. It was an absolute pleasure and an absolute honor to be a part of that podcast, especially in the middle of like all the fantastic guests that you've had so far. Well, thank you very much, Chris.